Hello and welcome back to Tech Days Online. I'm Andrew Fryer and I'm joined by my very good friend Rick Hepworth, spelt properly.
All these years and he's finally managed to make a complete mess of it on live broadcast. There's a C, no C in mine. You've got me at it now. What's that mean? Duh.
So serverless or less servers, although I'm not allowed to say that, am I?
Fewer servers. We are serverless because we have fewer servers. Do they not teach you this in school anymore?
No, well, I did go to grammar school. So, Rick, obviously, most of today we've been looking at individual bits and pieces of the goodness that is Azure. And what we want to do now is, I guess, understand when to use what. I think you've got a favourite expression that sums this up really neatly.
Yeah, so, I mean, we thought we'd try and do this session as a bit of a chatty, interactive one. And we've got our trusty blackboard up here, like the old school fusty headmasters we are. So let's start with the important message, which is this one. Friends don't let friends do IaaS. And as you can see, my handwriting is absolutely appalling. And we'll let Andrew do most of the drawing for most of the session because he's wonderfully talented at that. I just want to get that one across. I do a lot of work with customers and I do a lot of evangelism where I'm talking to people about how they move to the cloud. And what we're going to talk about today is serverless. And I always think that's a bit of an end game. It's the end of the spectrum, if you like. What a lot of people say they want to do when they first move to the cloud is a lift and shift of servers.
Mm.
And that's okay, but you're not getting any benefit. So when we think of moving to the cloud, we're really thinking about trying to reduce management overhead. We're trying to reduce business risk, aren't we?
And well, for me, it's actually about agility. I mean, we can make all the economic arguments you want. This is cheaper than that, and you can do that race to the bottom thing. But for me, in this very uncertain world in which we live in today, plus all the innovations going on, it's how agile can you be compared with your competitors to seize that next opportunity? How fast can you get your next release of code out of the door? And as a hardened IT pro, I kind of have had to change with the times, and that's why I'm really interested in what you've got to say here, Rick, because actually I don't really want to be the pinch point in the process. I want to be able to facilitate what you're trying to do. I want to be the good guy. Please, can I be the good guy?
No, I think that's fair. So, I mean, we want to get away from building servers, don't we? We want to get away from patching servers. So PaaS, Platform as a Service, I really see as the way to take advantage of the cloud.
Yeah.
So. We might look upon IaaS as a gateway drug, that we've already got our application, right? It's running in IIS, you've got your SQL server. In order to first move into Azure, we're going to move those virtual machines. But very, very rapidly, we want to try and re-engineer our application, so we're using maybe SQL Azure, and we're using Azure App Services to host our website. So now we've gone through PaaS, and we get the benefits of not having to manage those servers. We get better scalability, because we can now use all of the really cool features in SQL Azure, so we can scale up as we need to. We can use the cool features in App Service for resilience, for load balancing, that kind of stuff. But there's still one thing missing, if you like, as far as I'm concerned in our cloud journey, which is if you think about IaaS, effectively I'm renting clock cycles from you. Now, I've got a server up there, and I'm running that, and it's on 24 hours a day, so I'm paying you for 24 hours a day of compute. App Services is really the same thing, if you think about it. Whilst sure, I've got my elastic scale, so I'm paying for a smaller number of clock cycles, at the end of the day, my App Service is still ticking over, even if nobody's looking at my website.
Yeah, to a certain extent that's true, yeah.
One of the key benefits I think of with serverless is if it's not running, it's not consuming clock cycles and I'm not being charged. And I think in this modern world where a lot of organizations are startups, they've got a business pitch that they're not really sure whether that's going to fly or not. They start with the free service to people to build awareness. Being able to manage that cost is one big key factor in why you might go cloud.
Right, okay.
The second factor in serverless, I think, is to your point earlier on, agility and speed. So the aim with serverless is that you're building small, discrete, loosely coupled components. Each one of those components should be relatively quick and straightforward to write. And the idea is that by joining them together, we build our greater whole.
Right, yeah? Okay, got the idea.
And I know from experience that by tackling projects in that way and using some of the Azure serverless technologies, we can both massively condense the time it takes to write a new application, but also because we've broken that structure down, we've got a lot less risk. We've got a lot less risk that something's going to go wrong in development because each component is smaller. We can have one dev on one discrete element rather than lots of devs working across each other in a shared code base.
Yeah.
We've got a much easier testing regime because now we have a set of individual Lego bricks that we can test each one in turn and make sure they work in isolation and then that they work as a whole. And what that means is we've got less business risk because the overall quality of our offering is going to be higher. And when we launch our shiny new service of, I don't know, Fryer's Pizza as a service, you know that it's going to scale, it's going to be robust, and you're not going to get a whole load of unhappy customers.
Kind of understand. Another thought occurs, if you're writing these individual like APIs, these small things that do something really well, and we'll need to show people what those are in a minute, you don't have to write them all in the same language.
No, you don't. No.
So if I've got different skills in my team, or that some problem is particularly susceptible to a particular language, then I can loosely couple a different bits and fusion cuisine kind of, to use the pizza thing,
absolutely.
We can absolutely do that.
So yeah. One of the messages of this 3 days of Tech Days, really, isn't it, is that Azure is an open cloud.
Yeah.
So we don't really mind what language you bring to the party.
Mm.
So we're going to talk about what Azure services we class as serverless in a moment, but there's a range of languages that we can write stuff in. If you want to do C#, fine. If you're a functional guy and you want to do F#, that's okay. If you want to do it in Node, that's fine too. Bash scripting, all of these things can be brought to the party. Mm. So as an organization, you can really build on the skills you've already got in your team and move into the cloud. And again, de-risk that move because you're not having to change technology horses.
Right, so let's have a look and see what this thing looks like in Azure.
Absolutely. So let's talk about the services that are definitely serverless. Do you want to write since you have such wonderful handwriting?
Well, I can, okay.
Pass the baton. So I think of there as that there's been three Azure services that we can definitely say are serverless. One is Azure Automation. The second, what a wonderful picture.
Well, it's a gear.
Ah, right. I thought you were drawing me a flower, mate.
Oh, thank you. I'll see you later.
Or misty-eyed.
Okay. Now that to me feels like my old traditional world. That's the kind of thing that I used to do to make sure I didn't run up a big bill with those awful IaaS machines by turning off my VMs every night or reducing scale and so on and so forth. But you see that as a serverless thing because I suppose it can call anything.
So when I'm thinking of service, I'm looking for a set of characteristics. So I'm not renting compute. It's run on demand and I'm charged per execution.
Yeah.
And Azure Automation fits that criteria.
Okay,
it's really looking at how I can drive automation perhaps from an IT pro perspective because we're using PowerShell runbooks. But so what? It's a serverless offering that means that I can put scheduled tasks or triggered tasks in Azure to do my housekeeping. Maybe I'm deleting old documents from Azure storage.
Yeah.
Maybe
yeah.
I am indeed closing down servers on a whim. But importantly, if that function fires at 5 o'clock in the evening and turns my servers off, I only pay for that one instance that it fires.
Yeah, 15p or whatever. Well,
exactly.
Not even that, 1.9, I can't remember how much, it's not a lot.
So, my favorite example of cost, I wasn't going to talk about it yet, my favorite example of cost was an Azure function, which we trigger a million times in a month that runs for a second, will cost you 12 pence.
Okay, very good.
So you can see the kind of cost scaling we get on this.
So it's amazing how many people don't know about Azure Automation because, again, I kind of think, oh, it's great, PowerShell's great, and we always go on about that, but where are you going to run it? Well, then you've got to spin up a VM, and then it's got to sit there, and then you've got to make sure that it's on. And we do all of that work for you. So that's very much in the spirit of it, I suppose.
Yeah, I think so. And I think I don't see it just as an IT pro thing. You know, if your developers could have housekeeping tasks that are running as part of your application that are driven by Azure Automation.
And certainly everywhere I go, I find that I'm explaining this to people who've never seen it before. So I think that's a fair one. Okay, what have you got next for us?
So second up is Azure Functions, which is the new kid on the block. I'm curious to see what the icon's going to be for that one, mate.
I think it's supposed to be a bolt of lightning.
Yeah. Whizzy. Okay.
Okay.
So this is why I let him draw. So like I said, Azure Functions are a bit of a new kid on the block, but I think they're incredibly powerful and they're incredibly flexible. So these are the ones where as you were alluding to, we can bring a whole raft of different languages to the table. So we can do C Sharp, F Sharp, Node, Bash. We can even bring our own executable if we want. Mm. And they are very, very cheap to run a single execution of.
Mm-hmm.
But they're also incredibly elastic and scalable overall. And to try and give you an example, we've done some work with functions. And we were doing a demonstration for a customer. And it was one of those where we had no revenue coming in from this. It was a technology demonstration. So it's the age old, you know, you're trying to do something relatively inexpensive, but you're also trying to impress the customer. And at the back of our minds, we also had the slight worry that this wasn't just being built for a 40-minute demo for the customer. Mm. They actually wanted to go and kick the tires. So this was all about uploading video. So we built a very, very lightweight website in Angular. Mm-hmm. All the back-end stuff was done in functions. And we had a function that was triggered, because as your functions, you work on a trigger to actually start it, and that trigger could be an activity, like in our case, being a file being dropped into blob storage.
Right.
Or it could be on a schedule, or it could be service bus if you want to trigger it from messaging on a service bus. So we got a very simple function where when you dropped a video into Azure Storage, this function woke up, read the video, took the EXIF information out of the video and got the GPS coordinates and stuffed those into DocumentDB.
Right.
So it's really quick, just did one thing, did it really quickly. We then got another website that allowed you to search for videos based on your position. So we had another function that took your position, searched DocumentDB, and returned a list of videos in that vicinity. The benefit of using functions to us was that we could put a number of different devs, one working per function, in parallel. So we could massively reduce the elapsed time that we worked on the project.
Mm.
It was very easy to test because it was all discrete. And when we made it available to the customer, I wasn't worried about scalability or performance. I didn't have to have something that was always on for a month or two while they kicked the tires.
Yeah.
I knew that I'd only be charged for those instances that they used. And it was a really great success story for Azure Functions. And I have lots of conversations with customers along similar lines to that.
However, I guess like everything, Azure Functions aren't necessarily a magic bullet. So what do you see as the gotchas when we're looking at this particular technology?
So part of this, I think, harks down to architecture, and you've got to be a little bit wary of buzzword bingo. So I get a lot of conversations now about microservices.
Yes.
And I can see an argument that says Azure Functions is a microservice, but actually I would argue that perhaps a function is smaller than a microservice.
Okay.
Yeah. In that, so if we're talking about microservices, we're talking about things that are running perhaps in a container, or we're deploying them with Service Fabric.
Yep.
And an individual service might have a number of functions within it to perform. Azure Functions, I am a firm believer, does what it says in the tin. One function does one function. So effectively, it's a building block level smaller, if you like.
It's very much transaction based in the way you're saying it. So it's not like a big long running thing that's going to ingest tons of data.
Can have long running functions.
Oh, okay.
But I think with my personal hat on, I'm not sure that I would. If I've got something that's going to be long running, to an extent, I may as well put it in something like an app service host. I might want to look for a different service to run.
And then you would just call this iteratively from that that site, notification service or whatever. Is notification service still there?
Yes, notification hubs are still there.
Good, good.
So, I mean, I think functions have a role to play as part of your healthy, balanced diet of cloud.
Yeah.
So you might not build your whole application in functions, but you might build certain discrete elements of it, or you could. So the segues nicely onto our third member of the family. We have Azure Logic Apps.
Uh-huh.
Go on, then work out the icon for that one.
Oh, well, I'm probably going to draw some sort of brain.
Oh, very nice.
That's supposed to be a brain, everybody. Probably not a very good-looking brain. Logic Apps.
So logic apps are all about really moving data around and putting some lightweight workflows in. Again, to give you a tacit example, we've done some work for customers where they want to get work out of information out of Salesforce. So you've got a logic app. You create the logic app and you connect it to a system and say, okay, poll Salesforce once a minute, and if a new customer turns up, suck that data out, do a bit of transformation on it, put it over here in Microsoft CRM, say.
Right, okay.
Yeah? So it's building glue between systems.
So this sounds a bit like, I vaguely remember, you know, when we first met, I think the company you work for, we'd have to mention Black Marble. We're going to mention Black Marble anyway. But you're big into BizTalk, aren't you? Yep. And that felt like that kind of world. You're brokering a contract between two companies who've got different systems doing essentially the same function, CRM or ERP or whatever it is. And you need to be able to take a transaction seamlessly through there and translate it into this new world, but still respecting, you know, things like transactions and so on.
Yeah. So I mean,
and that's
indeed
what this would do.
So logic apps are the same team as BizTalk.
Ah, okay.
I think it's important to say that thinking of logic apps as just the cloud analog of BizTalk is a bit of a misnomer, because there are things that BizTalk is very good at that logic apps are less good at. If latency is an issue for you, or you've got very long running complex workflows, you might want to do that in BizTalk on-prem.
Right.
But logic apps are, again, quick and easy plumbing in the cloud, particularly if you're wiring together cloud systems.
Mm-hmm.
So you can maybe start to see from this that we can build actually quite complex applications through a series of blocks that are themselves triggered. So a function can trigger a logic app. A logic app can trigger a function.
I was just going to say, is there a use case for integration here? And it's, again, an appropriate use of technology. This is, for me, if I think about my SQL world, this would be a stored procedure, and this would be a function a stored procedure would call, potentially.
Yeah, that's not a bad analogy.
Because I tend to think stored procedures are running over, you know, we put things like cursors in them, we iterate over a data set. Whereas typically a function, it's a scalar function, I'm just going to look at one row and I'm going to do something with that, like your analogy of getting a geospatial information out of one document. This is going to iterate, kick off at 12 o'clock every night, and maybe say, okay, I've got 1,000 of these things, and I'm going to call that thing 1,000 times in some sort of loop.
Absolutely. So I do just want to call out the charging model for logic apps, because it's slightly different from functions.
Yep, okay.
But only slightly, to be fair. So you'll remember from how I described logic apps, there's really two parts to it. I'm looking at something.
Yeah.
You know, I'm polling Salesforce, and then if something's happened that I'm interested in, I'm doing something.
Yeah.
So I get charged for that poll in logic apps.
Yeah.
And I also get charged for the steps I execute if I realize I need to do some work. So it's a similar charging model to functions in that I'm charged for the execution, but I also have this sort of polling going on, if you like, that I'm charged for as well. But the combination of those is still probably a lot cheaper than having to run services maybe in what used to be a worker role, web jobs or something like that, where I'm writing the code that's going out and polling, and I'm writing the code that's then doing all of the munging of my data. And I think, if you like to keep banging on about the moral of all of this, it's the speed and simplicity of building your applications. You know, I could start off with one simple logic app, then I grow it and I start calling functions. Then I've got lots of them, so I stick Service Bus in to manage messaging between them.
Right.
You know, maybe I'm looking for data stores. I could talk to Azure SQL. I could talk to DocumentDB. And then finally, as we start to try and commercialize this and publish it to the outside world, something that isn't serverless, because we do pay for a certain reservation of compute, but we bring API management into the frame.
Right.
And one of the things that's really great about API management is it will look into my Azure subscription and it'll find my functions and logic applications.
Ah.
And it'll let me publish those out as a single coherent API. And I can then do things like version control it. So I could have a V1 function and a V2 function.
And does that work with logic apps as well?
It does work with logic apps as well. And to be fair, with API management, I can publish out, if you like, traditional APIs. I can have some kind of RESTful API that's hosted in app services. But the difference there, if you like, is if I have a V1 and a V2 and they're hosted in two separate app service instances, I'm paying for two app service instances.
Yep.
And I can't turn one off until I know my customers have migrated. If I've built it using functions, well, if hardly anybody's using V1, well, it's just not executing, so it's not costing me anything. But the customer thinks I have a very, very rich, coherent API, because I do. But behind the scenes, it's built from these loosely coupled, one would almost go so far as to say microservices. I just don't like using the term for describing functions.
So I just want to get this point about, so what we're saying, just to go back a step, because service broker, that is the handoff between data passing parameters between different functions.
Okay.
Would that be a good,
comfy with that.
Sorry, it's a really slow PowerPoint deck, this. But what we want to be able to do here is functions, is to make sense of all of this. Because what occurs to me is you've got all these little bits and pieces scattered over Azure now. We're using four potential services here, fronted by some notification services web apps, that's five. And I'm now the guy in charge, your boss. And I'm trying to make sense of the costing and billing and all this. I need to get my head around that. And also, people are rightly concerned about dependency on a service like Azure, or the other cloud providers are available, and how easy it is to unpick this and put this and port it and put it somewhere else or redo it. In other words, if I'm so locked into this infrastructure, am I not in a bad place?
So I think resilience is an interesting point. So if we talk about our virtual machines that we started the session with, when I deploy a virtual machine, I don't get any kind of SLA from Microsoft in terms of keeping my services up. There are SLAs around the machine uptime, but if I haven't provisioned more than one machine, the guys who run Azure have to patch the systems that my VM's hosted on. It is going to go down.
Yeah.
App services gets a bit better because the way those are deployed and instanced, it's a lot quicker. The serverless stuff is abstracted higher still.
Mm-hmm.
So if you like, I'm a lot less at risk to individual service outages within an Azure data center. I'm a lot less likely to notice a blip in my service if I architect using this lot.
Yeah. What I more meant was more the risk around associated with how locked into Azure you are when you develop this kind of, and how easy it would be to unpick and recreate this somewhere else if I wanted to. Because that's always a concern. For our customers when they're looking at this stuff, yeah?
So I think it's certainly fair to say. I mean, let's be honest, if we're having a sales customer conversation, we like PaaS because it is stickier than IaaS in a customer relationship perspective. But I do like to think of it this way. So our devs are skilled in .NET, right?
Yeah.
Or maybe they're skilled in Node.js, whatever. We've brought them into Azure. Mm-hmm. We've not changed their skill set. They're still writing discrete functions in the programming language of their choice. Sure, I lose some of the magic glue, if you like, that if I take it out of Azure, I've then got to write the connector for Salesforce. I've got to write the connector for whatever my database is. But my business logic's still there.
Fantastic. So what we're saying is the sort of pixie dust we've created, if you like, is scattered across Azure. But if we went back, say, 5 or 10 years, we would be probably writing this modular code in the same way, with stitching it together in the same way. So this is just good dev practice applied to Azure, which I think is perhaps a valid way of looking at it as well.
And I think actually one of the big value arguments is your devs are now focused on writing the bit that's making you money because it's your business logic. They're not reinventing the wheel of writing all those interconnects.
Mm.
It's the same argument as to why would you use Azure AD? Well, why would you write your own identity provider?
Sure. Why do you write your own word processor? I mean, you can take it to...
Why would you write your own interconnect logic if there's something like Logic Apps there that's already there? Why would you write your own automation host if Azure Automation's already there?
Okay.
And I think... Cloud is a sort of a journey and a spectrum. And there isn't necessarily a right or wrong answer as to what solution you use in the cloud. Depending on what you've built, maybe something like Docker and containers, that Rain's going to talk about tomorrow, might be the path of least resistance to adopt. Maybe if you've invested a lot in IIS and you've got a lot of web applications, you start on app services. But whichever, if you like, gateway drug you take, that shouldn't be the end of your journey. You should constantly be looking at what's out there to help you be more flexible, more resilient, more open to change, and frankly, more cost effective.
Yeah.
And I think we're going to see a lot more services move up that layer of abstraction.
Mm-hmm.
because you and I as businessmen don't want to invest our time in running this stuff. We want the Azure Pixies to deal with it. And yeah. we're all about the value add. We're all about the business logic and the presenting stuff out to our customers.
And I guess another corollary to what I've just been talking about you know, using, say, potentially now 4 or 5 of these different services. And you know, my division, we look at independent software vendors and their ability to essentially create software as a service, become a Salesforce, become a an office, whatever it is, and they need to be able to get this, you know, prediction and certainty around billing for a given scale of business that they're offering to their customers, and this is still going to enable them to do that.
Well, more so, arguably more so, because every time you execute my functions, I've got a click there that I can charge you for. So one of the interesting things that I do get though is a little bit of resistance, in that serverless has no innate constraints, if you like. So when I deploy an app service, I go, I want a standard, whatever it is, with so many calls and so much memory. So there's a set of walls there that I'm not going to break out. And if you first look at things like functions, the obvious worry is, well, crikey, I mean, if we really do get a huge response to our website, even in its free phase, we can run up a whacking great bill really quickly. But there are capabilities to throttle this stuff. So you can say, do not run more than so many executions in a given time.
And that would be in the Azure portal.
Yeah, so all of this is done through the Azure portal.
Yeah.
I'd like to talk a little bit about sort of DevOps and developing these things.
Yeah.
Because
let's get a new page up and
again, the Azure portal is your route into all of this stuff. Mm-hmm. You can drop into an Azure portal and you go, new logic app. New function. And one of the great things I think about accessibility of this new technology is that they give you a set of menus. Hey, you're making a function. Here's a set of canned templates you might want to start from. Do you want to start with a storage-based trigger or a service bus-based trigger? And they'll give you some scaffolding that you can then edit and work on.
Right, you get templates. And then obviously there's a gazillion samples on GitHub and so on and so forth. Right.
But the primary editing plane, if you like, that you'll find in blogs and videos is the Azure portal. And what you find with that, if you don't think it through carefully enough, is that your developers are either writing in the portal, and there isn't necessarily a good set of version control in there.
No.
Or they're copying and pasting out in and out of Visual Studio, which, to be fair, is what we had to do when they first came online and they hadn't really developed much.
So presumably now, I mean, when I think we've got Visual Studio Online, we've got obviously Visual Studio, at the time of writing, Visual Studio 2017 RC is out there for us to try. Is there special stuff in these newer versions to enable us to do some of this stuff? Because the whole point is, my hypothesis is, this is all about agility. Then it needs to be agile.
But it's with my DevOps hat on. It's fine being agile, but I need traceability. I need version control. And I need reliability.
But that's what I do mean by that, Rick. Yeah. I mean, you know, joking aside, we absolutely need to roll back. We need to do, you know, A/B testing, all of that kind of goodness that my Visual Studio buddies love chatting to you guys about. We don't want to throw the baby out of the bathwater. So can we develop our own functions? We've got a proper interface now.
Yeah. So what you can do now is you can connect a function to a Git repository.
Right.
So notice I say Git, not GitHub. GitHub is a Git source control system. Yeah. But Visual Studio Team Services also lets you have Git repositories.
So I've got my little function.
Yep. And it's connected to a Git repo, which our developer, so our developer's writing code in Visual Studio, and he commits that code to a Git repository. When we commit, our function sees that commit and gets the code and updates the function.
Oh, I didn't mean to do that. I meant to do that.
So I look upon that as step one. That's
the wrong way around, isn't it?
Yes, arguably for your code flow. Proof that we're live.
Oh, you swine. Cut.
And we're being agile and developing as we go. Our developer's down here, right? And he's pushing code into your Git repo. The Git repo is being watched by our function.
Yep.
And it pulls the code as it's updated. Now, what that allows us to do is it allows the developer to work in the tools that they know and love.
Yep.
Visual Studio.
See what I did there?
It immediately gives me source control because they're merrily committing to my VSTS hosted Git repo. And what I'd suggest is that this function here is probably running on their MSDN benefit subscription.
Right. Yeah,
so this is our test function.
Right.
That our developers pushing
so that's on,
to.
That's on MSDN, yeah.
Potentially. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I mean, this is what you do,
because
right?
We've got to think. So, okay. Well, yeah. You know, we need test and live environments.
Yeah, yeah,
we
sure,
don't
sure,
want to
sure.
just push code straight into live, because that way all kinds of craziness happens.
Yeah. Yeah. Indeed.
So, what we can then do is say, okay, well. I mean, we can think about how we can maybe do some automated testing of this. That's a conversation for a whole other day. But in the simplest form, our developer pushes code to Git, which goes to the function on MSDN. We test it, we make sure it works. And what we can then do is we actually put another repository in.
Another Git repository?
Yeah. So we push our tested code to a second repository. So we've got a gate, if you like. We've got a quality gate between our development code and our published artifacts. And our live function in our live subscription, with all of its SLA goodness, is watching that Git repository.
Well, I can't see. I seem to have lost the ability to draw a bolt of lightning here.
And once our code's been tested and we've proved it works, then we'll push it out to live. And it will automatically update that function. And the next time somebody triggers the function, it'll be running on new code.
Right, okay, I've got you.
Yeah, so yeah. Obviously we'd put various bits of automation and
Sure.
Was it sprinkle some DevOps on it, as Donovan Brown likes to say. We try and automate a lot of that process.
Yeah.
But that's a conversation I have quite a lot with customers, to make sure we put that sort of diligence in terms of process in place.
And importantly here, you've got this, and you've got your version controls. You can go back, you can fork, you can test, and so on and so forth.
Yeah,
right, cool.
Absolutely. Yeah, and we could if we wanted to. Maybe
and Logic Apps works in the same way. This is functions, isn't it?
I'm a little less clear on how Logic Apps works, just because I don't develop personally Logic Apps. But broadly speaking, yes, we can do deploys. So we in both cases, we can do deploys using ARM templates.
Yeah.
We can push out code to a Logic App through an ARM template.
Yeah, that's a Zero Resource Manager for those viewers at home. Yeah.
What I have fiddled with in the past is using our good old faithful MS Deploy package and injecting code in.
All right. Okay.
You can export Logic Apps as XML and JSON and push those back in. So you can take the JSON out of a working Logic App and push it into another Logic App.
So a customer who's deployed these functions could say, ask you guys to come in and say, look, here's the stuff I developed. Go and take it apart, put it back together, and can you make a change for us? Because you know, quite often you'll just get involved when there's a big change, but they might have an in-house development team and just doing the odd tweak and fiddle with it,
yeah.
and then you get it to work.
So I think it's a very fair point to raise, is that when we talk about Cloud Cadence and the speed of generating new services, these kind of services arrive, mm-hmm. and not all of the corners are squared away. So when functions first came out, we got working functions and they were great, but we didn't have a good DevOps management story.
Yeah.
That's not to say one doesn't come, but with all of these, you've got to sit down as a customer and think about how you're going to adopt them and how you're going to use them. And if there isn't a good DevOps story, how are you going to mitigate that in the short term while you start to adopt the tech?
Which is why we give you that MVP badge, I suppose, to go and kick the tire sometimes. Because I've got some friends of mine who wanted to write some functions, but I think although Python was, I think Python was quoted as experimental for this, so they felt they weren't ready to experiment yet. They hadn't got that appetite for risk, and quite rightly so. But when they have, they will, and so we just wait for that to come online, because their thing is they want to extract data directly from a MySQL database, and guess what? They've already written the Python for that, so they just want to be able to lift and shift that, and then make a call into, and then onward transmit that.
To give another tacit example then, I was doing some work a few months ago with an organization that had a very, very big SQL database and a set of web services, a website which they called web services, which talked to the database. When they actually looked at that database, it had grown up being SQL because our sort of document DBs didn't really exist.
Yeah.
But what they were storing in it was JSON.
Okay.
And they were searching within the database using free text searching, because they didn't really know the sort of schemas and things inside that. What we talked about was trying to look at how they could move to the cloud and take advantage of the new services. And we looked at sort of spike projects, if you like, as to, well, you know, can we take, first of all, just the function inside your web services that's doing data uploads and pushing it into SQL, can we take that out and turn it into a function? You know, so we've we're not trying to immediately change our architecture and move everything. And that function, to begin with, we just squirt the JSON still into SQL.
Yep.
But now we've separated it. So then we go, okay, well, the next step is, now we've got that function, can we set up a test document DB, and we'll squirt the same data into document DB, and let's see if we can actually kick the tires of document DB. And it's that slowly but surely cracking apart your monolithic app and using the way PaaS services are structured to help you move to the cloud and re-architect over time. Because let's face it, we don't necessarily have the investment in terms of time and capital to beautifully rebuild our application as we want to move to Azure. So we're back to that journey again.
Well, it's an inflection point usually in the business. There's something is broken. They've run out of server room. They've sometimes just a change of personalities in the organization, sometimes a change of direction of the company. But there's going to be an inflection point in the business, and that's the opportunity to presumably drive change, and that's what you see.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So, sorry, I'm just looking at the notes we've got about things we wanted to talk about. So let's just bounce back a little bit. You and I were having a bit of an interesting discussion earlier on as to what is and isn't serverless. Frankly, whether it makes a difference, which is an interesting conundrum. You were throwing a whole lot of data services at me and saying, are they or aren't they?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, data stores themselves, you're going to pay a persistent charge because you're paying for storage. It could be blob storage, and Amy and David did a great job this morning of this, and data lake storage, and they're going to vary according to how much you get. So I kind of get that. But one of the things that I love to play with is Azure Machine Learning. Now, that ultimately creates an API, but because it's probably creating an app service, in fact there's an app service plan when you create that API, you're back to that fixed cost again, so that wouldn't really be fitting this context. But on the other hand, I love the fact that a data scientist can imply somewhere inside your logic, say those images, and you can maybe pick out, I don't know, whether it's raining or not out of the photographs. Let's hypothesize that, and the organization, I'm not sure who wants these videos, but they need to know whether it's raining or not. We can kind of run an algorithm against that and say there's a 90% chance that's raining, and we can put that in that EXIF data, or we could go out and reach a weather forecast. But the person who's done that coding is an expert in R or Python, not necessarily in Angular or whatever it was that you wrote all the other stuff in, and we can kind of blend that into the mix. So I love the fact we can have specialists working in a familiar world, in their familiar world, and bring expertise to some of this.
Yeah, and I think that sort of echoes in what we've been saying, that serverless is not the new magic bullet. It's not to replace everything. So I think yours is a really great example where we're using a service that we just couldn't do on-prem. You know, Azure ML is something that's so incredibly hard to replicate. We've built that piece of bespoke code for our application in a way that we couldn't have done on-premises. Yes, we're paying for that. What we then do is we use functions and logic apps to communicate with that.
Yeah.
So I might have a function that calls your ML service and gets the response back. So it's all about, again, sort of breaking our application down into the right components and using the right tool for the right job. One of the conversations I keep having at the moment is everything's going to be, it's serverless, isn't it? The world's going serverless. It's like the world's going, 3 months ago, the world was going containers. Now the world's going serverless. Arguably, the world's going mad, but that's a different conversation.
Well, a completely different way for me thinking about this data is, imagine that moment. Many times when we take out a mortgage or a loan, they want to see a utility bill. Now, I don't know about our viewers, but certainly one thing I certainly do now is I opt in for electronic, because I figure that if somebody can use my utility bill, they can impersonate me. So actually having those utility bills lying around my house is actually a risk. Mm-hmm. So I'm not going to do that. So we need to think about that utility company is now essentially could charge for its data by creating an API. You give me a name and address, and I'll tell you whether they're paying their electricity bill at that address, yes or no. And if you don't know those two things, you won't get a yes or no answer. And all you're going to get back is a yes or no answer. And that seems to be much better than maybe them opening up all their data or selling their data or what have you. And then you could build these microservices to stitch together a system to authenticate people for taking out loans or buying houses or whatever it is. Well, I suppose the same thing. That kind of world, I think, is an interesting play for this technology as well, and used in a good way to mitigate data leaking all over the net, you know?
Yeah, I mean, so we're back to, what do we use the cloud for? So the cloud can do things that I can't.
Mm.
So the Azure cloud is really, really good at protecting me against DDoS attacks. It's protecting me against security intrusions. So if I've got a very, very rich set of services that I run on-premise, what I might do is use something like functions or logic apps and API management to present some of those services out to my customers and utilize Azure for the bits that I don't want to invest in. I don't want to expose me, my data center, my services to attack. I don't care about exposing your data center and services to attack. You're there already. You know,
well, we've got a couple
Xbox
thousand.
Xbox Live, MS Live, well, you know, you've got to deal with it yourself. So I can stand on your shoulders and use that. But I've done it in a very, very low risk, very cost effective, and importantly, very scalable way. And I know we keep sort of banging on about that in this session, but I think developers get functions. I sit down with devs and devs go, yeah, you know, we understand functions. We can write C#. We understand that we're just writing a small block of code that does a discrete thing. Sometimes it's the sort of architects that don't grok functions. It's where do you use it? Where do you deploy it? Where do you get benefit? And the businessmen don't grok functions. And I think part of the reason businessmen struggle to grok functions is because by that point we've broken our application down into such a large number of tiny bricks that you struggle to see the application at that point.
Yeah.
And I do spend a lot of my time talking about Lego analogies and drawing pictures and helping the businessmen understand why breaking down your application into lots of small components actually makes your life easier. And it'll give you a good return on investment in the longer run, which, let's face it, is what we're all in it for, isn't it?
Well, that's right. I mean, you're monetizing your application. Your API, you know, is the surface on surface area on your data. And I think if we put this in conversation, in context with some of the other sessions we had today about how we use different kinds of data, we use different kinds of ways of coding. And then DocumentDB, you know, we've heard from Alan already about how we've been able to, he's using functions and really gone largely services to populate that data because it's the right thing to do. But what I kind of guess our audience, and hopefully they're watching, as they're watching this, they're thinking, well, how do I, having watched this 45 minutes of us droning on and having some fun with a whiteboard, how do I learn more about this? How do I go and try some of this out? What would your advice be to them, Rick? I'm putting you on the spot here.
No, I'm glad you asked me that because I was thinking about the same thing just as we're approaching time and our cameraman was waving at us a few minutes ago. So first off, docs.azure.com, docs.microsoft.com even now, there's an awful lot of content about getting started with functions, about getting started with logic apps. They have links to content that's on GitHub, various samples that the team have been putting out there. There's an array of technical demos, which is why we didn't want to do one today, on Channel 9. So without even leaving the web browser you're sat in now, you can just get a search in the top right-hand corner and type in functions and start to find a load of stuff.
Yeah.
And I've also noticed that the number of meetups that are appearing in my inbox and the number of user groups just around me in the Leeds area where I am, there's a lot of people in user groups now talking about functions, doing sessions in functions. So I'd really, really plug your local user groups. I'd plug your local community conference. And I go along and talk to people. I think the thing about functions is that, if you like, the dry learning, the how do I do it, there's lots and lots of content from Microsoft. There's lots and lots of videos from Microsoft conferences. What's less obvious are the, well, I fell out of the tree and hit this branch on the way out down, and this is how you want to avoid it.
Well, how do I build the whole thing? You know, how do I take apart, I don't know, you know, we used to have AdventureWorks in SQL. How do I take apart that website and reimagine it in this new world, a model application perhaps in a way? Maybe you should write that after the show.
So interestingly enough, there's a lot of work going on in Microsoft, in the Azure team, in the patents and practices team. And again, on docs.microsoft.com now, you can find Azure Quick Start solutions and you can find sample service architectures where they've started to talk about, in a real-world commercial context, say, I don't know, we want to build a global website. Well, what are the Azure services that we would use for that? How would we combine them and give you the sample architectures? And with some of those, there's even sample code starting to come along and guidance on that. So docs.microsoft.com, I'll mention it again, it's not a dry documentation site full of APIs, although there are APIs on there. It's now the one-stop shop if you want to learn about the Azure services and Azure tech.
Rick, I think we're about bingo for time. That went quite well, really, considering we didn't use any slides. But what I am going to ask you to do is to go on to Channel 9 Facebook, get some social message out there with some of those links that you've described, and then I'm going to let you go and prepare, because you're pretty much in the big chair all day tomorrow, aren't you?
I am indeed. Since we've got a moment, I will plug tomorrow. We've got a fantastic day tomorrow. It's all about the open cloud. We've got bringing your PHP MySQL app. We've got monitoring it, monitoring your Linux solutions. We've got a containers session from the wonderful Raina Stropek. It's going to be a really, really great day, so don't miss that one. Thanks,
okay, Andy. And we'll be back after the break with Dr. Mike Rees. Mike does big data, and he's going to tell us to go and jump in a lake.